Hi, and welcome back to the Gastronauts Podcast. My name is Peter, and I'll be your host. Here at Gastronauts, we are committed to exploring communication throughout the body, with a particular focus on the crosstalk between gut and brain. We invite experts in this field to share both their research and their incredible journeys. So come join me as we explore the steps that go into shaping a scientist on the Gastronauts Podcast. We have two more young scientists who have been incredibly successful in studying how microbes or bacteria in our gut can affect our brain. First up, we have Dr. Carlotta Randa, who is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Systems Biology at Columbia University in Dr. Harris Wong's lab. She received her PhD from the Technical University of Denmark in Dr. Alex Tuftgaard's lab, where she designed new genetic engineering tools to accelerate the development of biosustainable cell factories. She is currently a Simon Society Junior Fellow, and her research focuses on engineering tools to modulate or modify the gut microbiome. So thanks so much for being on, Dr. Randa.
Thanks for having me here. I'm very excited.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to ask about is to ask you to elaborate a little bit more on the two things that I introduced and tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you're working on.
So as you know, the gut microbiome is inhabited with a variety of different bacteria, and a lot of them, they're not very readable to or amenable to manipulations or genetic manipulations. So it's very difficult to try to understand the physiology of the gut without considering our microbiomes. Could be skin, it could be gut. Right. And so if we wanted to really understand these microbic communities, we need to be able to cultivate them or manipulate them and try to sample their functions. And so what I'm doing is trying to devise method that allow us to unravel or deconvolute this complexity. The ability to create tools that allow us to shine some light on their functions and their physiology and how they interact with the host, which is us, it's really important to really understand the physiology. And so, like, my work is trying to devise new method to understand how these communities behaves and how these communities interact with the host and allow us to better, like, understand their functions and their role in the human physiology.
Right. So I really want to take kind of a 30-foot view, mm-hmm. or 30,000-foot view, take a step back. So we've talked a lot about the microbes within the gut. Are there bacteria kind of living on other organ systems within our body? What made you choose to focus specifically on the gut microbes?
So yes, there are other microbiomes. We have skin microbiomes. We have eye microbiome. There are we discover a new microbiome everywhere, every day almost. Like, there was like a new hint where they even discuss about a potential brain microbiome, which it's kind of very controversial. Wow. The reason to dive into the gut is because it's one example of microbiome mm-hmm. that has been already extensively studied. And so people are very interested in understanding it because its role in physiology and disease has become extremely evident in the past like 5 to 10 years. So that's why I've decided to work on the gut. Mm-hmm. But I will expand my work, and my tools are expendable, mm-hmm. or like the tools I devise are expendable to other microbiome.
But the gut microbiome is the most densely enriched population of microbes mm-hmm. throughout our entire body. We may have these bacteria living on different organs, but the gut is the most well-studied, and the most number of bacteria live on the gut. Could you speak a little bit to, you know, the stability and the transient nature of our gut microbiome and how you will potentially target those?
The gut microbiome is extremely dynamic. Mm-hmm. It constantly changes. It changes with the circadian rhythm. It changes based on the food we eat, the place we live. So it's a very dynamic system. And so it is very difficult to really engineer them and have them stably maintain the same community as at the beginning, unless you have a specific fitness advantage that you can confer to specific spaces. Mm-hmm. So you can give, for example, if you want to select for specific a member of the communities, you can provide them specific substrates that mm-hmm. they grow on and give them a fitness advantage to persist within the community right. and to have like and to bloom within the community and to change their abundance within the community. So if you wanted to modulate the community, not at a specific genus or species level, but at the genetic content, right. then it's a completely different matter. Because at that point, the reprogram function that you wanted to give to the community is genetically encoded. And when it's genetically encoded, it can be hosted by different species, and it's not necessarily linked. You can make it to be broad and hosted by different species and not directly linked to one single population. And so in that scenario, you want to give genetic stability to the reprogram functions that you engineer within the community. So engineering the community, it's actually a very broad term, but it involves like multiple levels. You right. can work at the populations at the genus and species level and their fluctuations within the yeah. community. You can work at the genetic content.
And is a lot of your work on the engineering focused on modifying it at the genetic level, not so much on the species level or the population level? You're more interested, your work is currently more focused on genetic reprogramming or targeting a wide variety of species just based off of their genomes. Is that correct?
Yeah, so right now I'm working on genetic reprogramming because you have more stability on genetic reprogramming, mm-hmm. and it's not a trivial problem to give an increase of fitness or like provide fitness mm-hmm. advantage to specific species, because the gut microbiome has an incredible metabolic capacity and plasticity, so it's very difficult to find molecule metabolites that they are unique that you can use as a driving force, as like a selecting force to give the populations you're interested in a fitness advantage. Right. So work at a genetic level mm-hmm. allow us
more to... More tight control, essentially.
To get a more tight control and also allow us to have the reprogram function more pervasive, because you can target multiple species. Mm-hmm. And so the reprogram function will be propagated within the populations and not restricted to only one species. Mm-hmm. So if you have a beneficial function and you wanted to enhance your microbiome capacity mm-hmm. and you wanted to have it a lot of it, or you wanted to have like a substantial difference from your like baselines in terms of like productions, and maybe one species is not enough to drive that enhancement. Mm-hmm. So if you actually reprogram the functions within multiple species, then you can increase you can propagate it and you can increase the performance. And so you can increase enhancement if mm-hmm. you want to reprogram the function it. And so.
So by genetically reprogramming, you're introducing kind of a new type of DNA into this bacteria to give it a fitness advantage or to allow it to produce a particular metabolite. Is this correct?
So the best scenario would be mm-hmm. to link the fitness advantage
yep.
with specific functions you're interested in.
Okay.
Let's assume that you wanted to increase the serotonin level and to, instead of taking antidepressant, you want to increase the serotonin level. And yeah. so the gut is it's actually the major producer of serotonin. Yeah. And so, but this person is depressed, doesn't produce it that much. You mm-hmm. want to increase the productions and use it as alternative to antidepressant. Mm-hmm.
Are you focusing on any particular bacterial populations, or do you just see it as just increasing the total amount of serotonin for this example?
So Microbiome engineering is a very broad term, and it is actually composite of multiple nuances, and then it depends on the question you're asking or what you're looking for. And so if you are looking for just like an increased production from one single species, then my suggestion is, which I have other project where I'm currently working on, where you just engineer a single probiotic, which is specialized to produce that specific molecules, and then you give as like as it was like as a drug, and then as a single entity is optimized for the productions of that molecules, and you'll have a lot of release. But the problem with these specific probiotic is that they cannot stay, they cannot stick in the microbiome, they can't colonize, they just will be washed so out. You will be washed out pretty fast. So the engraftment or the colonizations, it's a major factor when we are discussing about probiotics. Right. So, and if you reprogram your own microbiome to a certain function, then you don't have this colonization problem, and then you can have a constant release. So you can modulate the time of release of your drug, and you can maintain the release of your drug. Okay, let's assume that you eradicate completely a species, which can happen, extinction of a species in your microbiome because of diet, because of like abuse of antibiotics. Then how can you perform their functions? How can you you can try to reintroduce that species,
certainly,
but you're not sure they will engraft because you already have your own community, and they might not engraft. So if you want that function to be performed, you can just recode it in and deliver it and reprogram already existing species to actually do that instead of reintroduce the old microorganism. So
this genetic engineering is more kind of like a personalized approach, as opposed to using one probiotic to give to everyone. You change your individual microbiome.
Exactly. The idea is to try to go towards a personalized approach where you don't take a generic probiotic. You don't take other people microbiome. Getting microbial community from other individuals has been shown to be an extremely effective system for C. diff infections. Certainly. And so it is a very powerful and effective treatment, but there are still like open questions if it is the best approach
because there's so many things unknown about the transplant.
Exactly.
Certainly. It's more controlled with the kind of genetic engineering.
Yeah, and also like what is the best microbiome to give? We don't know. Like there are super donors where the microbiome of those super donor seems to be more effective and to be able to colonize better. But like, what are the rules that make a super donor a super donor? We don't know them yet, not as well. There are efforts in trying to understand what is the holy grail of microbiome to cherry pick specific species and create like a perfect fecal transplant microbiome. Yeah. But you never know. Yeah. Well, you never know. So far, sorry, I have to correct myself. We don't know
at this point, certainly,
what can happen in the host. Yeah. Because there is also like host physiology, host genetics.
Changes as well, yeah.
That can the host physiology, host physiology and genetic can have an influence, obviously, in the colonization process and the shaping of the community, but also into the reacting to specific species. So these are still open questions that we haven't addressed yet.
It's an exciting place to do some research.
Yeah, it's an exciting place.
So we've definitely talked a lot about the uncertainties kind of with regards to the whole microbiome sphere currently, which makes it such an appealing kind of avenue for people to do genetic engineering, for people to study kind of what exactly in these microbial populations is beneficial. And I was wondering, as you start to transition to running your own laboratory, what are some of the big questions that you want to answer with or using microbial engineering?
So the fundamental questions that we're still trying to address in the field is like the actual mechanism, how the microbial communities, they can affect human physiology. At the mechanistic level, we are still lacking a lot of actually like knowledge. If we wanted to really understand and unravel the complexity of the community that he inhabited us, we wanted to try to modify them and understand how they interact with the host. If you conceptualize the microbiome as a complex network of different nodes and different points where each node is a species or a micro consortia, then you try to simplify a problem, which is if you wanted to understand that network, what you're going to do, you're going to try to twitch and manipulate and take away or like introduce new nodes so you can see how the network reacts to the specific changes. And by looking how the natural reshape after you change these nodes, you understand the role of those nodes. So the method, the genome engineering, it's the tool of genome engineering, of this type of tool that allow us to manipulate specific species, to manipulate the community, to manipulate specific bacteria, allow us to take out or put in new node in this network. Mm-hmm. They allow us to really deconvolute the complexity of this network.
Because the microbial community and even kind of the host physiology communities are so complex that we have to break it down. We have to take it kind of one piece at a time and then look at everything that changes from this one manipulation. Because if we try and change many things at the same time, you don't know what is causing kind of the whole change in the network. So, do you think there will come a time where we have all the tools to understand each of the nodes within the network? Or do you think that is kind of within the near future, far away, with regards to understanding kind of these subpopulations of bacteria and how each one of these subpopulations affects the entire network?
I think there are multiple efforts to actually do that, to try to understand what is the contribution of each species within the community at the community level, and also how that species by itself affect the physiology of those. I think the whole field is like trying to really understand and map out these interactions and these roles. I can't give a definite answer that it will be at one point that we will know everything, because it's like asking, like, we will know all biology at one point. It is so difficult to say, like, okay, we will know everything, because like it's so
there's so much
complex
room
to unravel that I don't see it as like complete work within a time frame that I can picture, you know. It's exciting. It's a very exciting, flourishing field. And people are tackling the problem from different angles. That's what is fine. That is what is very fascinating.
Well, that's really great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your excitement with us, Dr. Rhonda. And thank you for being on our podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me here. It's been great.
We also have Dr. Martina Skrita here with us today. She is a postdoctoral researcher at Baylor College of Medicine in Dr. Mauro Costamattioli's laboratory. She completed her PhD at the University of Pavia on spike timing-dependent plasticity in the laboratory of Dr. D'Angelo. Her current research is quite different and focuses on understanding mechanisms that underlie social behavioral deficits in autism spectrum disorder. Her recent publication in the journal Neuron showed how transplantation of a specific bacterial strain in the gut is able to enhance social behavior within mice. Can you tell us a little bit more about this project and additional projects that you're working on?
Of course. Hi, everybody. So, well, my project was kind of a follow-up from a previous project that previous work published in our lab. So a former colleague, Shelley Buffington, found how a specific bacterial strain was reduced in the gut microbiota of this environmental model of mouse model for ASD, autism spectrum disorder. And this was a maternal high-fat diet model. So she found that these mice that were born from mother fed with a high-fat diet were socially impaired, and this specific microbial strain was reduced in their gut. And socially found that reconstituting this microbe-specific lactobacillus strain in their gut was correcting the social deficits. So a lot of questions were open, remain open after this work, and that's how my work started, my project started. We wanted to understand whether this same treatment was also able to correct the social behavior in other mouse model, not just the one coming from, you know, the environmental factors, but also the ASD mouse model that were, you know, related to genetic factors or the combination of genetic environmental factor or other environmental factors. And so we started considering other model and treating the mice with the same bacteria, and we found that the same single strain, bacterial strain, was able also to correct social deficits in other mouse model. And this was very nice because regardless the cause of the ASD, regardless the first insult, this bacterial strain was still able to, you know, correct social deficits.
Do you think that these bacterial strains could be more generalized to not even just mice that had social deficits, people even extending beyond kind of the autism spectrum disorder sphere, taking this to just in general enhancing sociability, or does it change sociability?
Well, we hope that. We also are trying to understand whether this bacterial strain is also correcting other behavior, because as you know, autism spectrum disorder is heterogeneous is a spectrum. So there are a lot of other comorbidities and phenotype, like repetitive behavior, language impairment. So it would be nice if it's just one single treatment could cure all the comorbidities. It's not very realistic, I guess.
Certainly.
I think the most amazing thing would be to understand which is the function of different bacteria, and maybe to, you know, combine different bacterial strain to have a correction of different phenotypes.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You're getting into the bacterial sphere, but your previous work kind of in your PhD was more kind of electrophysiology.
Absolutely.
So how did you need any convincing to kind of study bacteria? Did Mauro tell you that, oh, you're going to work on bacteria now? Or
no.
How did this come about?
Not at all. Well, I started working basic science, very basic, like on cerebellar circuitry, so in synaptic plasticity in the cerebellum. And I have always been attracted by something that was more preclinical. And I tried to have to be involved in projects that were more clinical, preclinical, during my PhD. It was very difficult because it was a very electrophysiology based lab, so we were really just studying basic neural circuitry. Mm-hmm. And so I decided I wanted to move, and I wanted to try to do research in US because there is a lot of money here, so a lot of fundings, and this I think is a step you have to do, right, when you do research, to try to travel and to have and make different experiences in other countries. So I looked for a lab that I could have been interested in, and Mauro's lab. Mauro, actually, I heard about Mauro during a talk at FANS in Europe, and he was. I got attracted by the research he was doing in his lab, so I asked him an interview. And when I got in the lab, they just started this gut-brain axis project, and actually he didn't need to convince me because I've been always fascinated about this, you know, aspect of science.
Yeah. Really cool.
Yeah.
I wanted to unpack a little bit more about your talk about you need to travel places, right? You were previously doing your PhD in Italy, and you decided to come to the U.S. because you wanted to expand your kind of opportunities. And here, you know, I'm from the U.S. doing my PhD here. I don't really think about going to other countries, and I haven't thought about it until kind of right now. I was wondering what made you decide to kind of focus on this in the United States, or was it a lab-specific thing? Just walk us through a little bit what's going through your
head. It was United States because, you know, Italy is an amazing country, but we don't have a lot of funding for research, for scientific research. And we always look at the U.S. as, you know, the dream place where you can do all the research you want, because there is so much funding that you can, you know, everything is accessible. You have to learn a specific technique, and your boss can send you in another, you know, lab, and for like 1 week and learn that technique, or you need a specific antibody to just order it. And, you know, in Italy, I remember we were really desperate. We were changing, you know. I give you an antibody, you give me maybe a solution. Like everything was like that.
Trade.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so, you know, I always wanted to.
Do you
to
think
go
that
to
made you more careful kind of with your reagents?
When I started in US, I was putting so much attention in any prices that administrative assistant said, Martina, don't worry about it. I mean, we can buy this antibody. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. But it's still crazy, right? Because the amount of money that we spend in the U.S. on research, people feel is too much. But other researchers feel that we need more research. Exactly.
Yeah, like such as anything in our life. Yeah. We should just be more careful to, you know, not spend too much. Yeah. And yeah, so I wanted to go to U.S. for this reason, because of the more accessible, you know, life of a scientist, everything was more accessible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in particular Maurus Lab, just because I was attracted by the works that has been done in his lab.
Mm-hmm. Are there any challenges for applying to the United States as a foreigner and joining their lab? I know I've talked to some other people who are graduate students, and they tell me that the process to getting into a graduate program in the United States is much more challenging. Is it kind of a similar process that you face going for a postdoc? Or?
Yeah, well, in Italy, the PhD process, I think it's easier from one point of view and less from the other side. Mm-hmm. So let me explain this. So basically, we have usually a strict 3 years PhD program, so it's shorter, much shorter. Yeah. And this could be a good thing from one side. From the other side, doing a PhD in the U.S. is much longer, as you probably know, but at least you can have the opportunity to go out from the lab with much more experience, stronger maybe to start your postdoc and with more publication, especially because it's not that easy to publish a paper in 3 years. If something goes wrong, you're like, you know. Yeah. And so this is one part. And the other part of it is that, you know, you basically have this admission program is much longer. So it's probably you know, it's expanding even more the time you have to spend trying to get in the program. Mm-hmm. Well, in Italy, yes, it's much shorter and maybe it's easier. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to jump back to your research a little bit more. We talked about kind of looking at how this particular strain of bacteria, mm-hmm. L. reuteri, is able to modify social behavior in an autism spectrum disorder mouse. And I was wondering, where do you see kind of your next projects going? Are they even related, or are you going on a different front?
They are related, just mm-hmm. because I got so passionate about these that I don't want to leave it.
Yeah.
So the thing is that there are so many other things to understand about these, and I feel like I'm not done with this. Mm-hmm. I want to understand how, you know, we understood that these the mechanism underlying how these bacteria can correct social behavior is dependent on the vagus nerve mm-hmm. and on the oxytocin and dopamine system. But we don't know how exactly. We don't know how the vagus nerve, if the vagus nerve is activated by the bacteria, what is activating the vagus nerve? Something released by the bacteria or something released by the epithelial cells in the gut that mm-hmm. are activated by the bacteria? And so there is so much work to do.
Yeah. So looking particularly, are you moving on to studying particular components of the bacteria? Are you looking at specific subsets of these oxytocin cells? Or is this all within kind of the context?
Well, we need to dig deeper in any of these steps. So we want to understand what is released by the bacteria. So what is the molecule responsible? Maybe also which is the gene in the bacteria that is responsible to give this capability to root right to correct social behavior.
Then you could genetically modify other bacteria so that...
Exactly. Yeah. There are so many things that can be done. And then also at the level of the system level, the vagus nerve is activated. So is the activity changing mm-hmm. upon the perfusion of the bacteria? And how the oxytocin is increased? So is the activation of these paraventricular nuclei of the potalum, which is mm-hmm. the area where oxytocin is produced, that mm-hmm. is through the activation of the vagus nerve is increasing oxytocin okay. production. Mm-hmm. So there are, you know, many things to understand in any of the steps bringing to the change in behavior from the bacteria to the behavior. So
certainly. And if you're thinking this oxytocin production is involved in having more social behavior in an ASD model, why not just give oxytocin? Why go through this pathway?
Well, this is a good question, because oxytocin has been shown to increase social, mm-hmm. to improve social behavior in kids yep. with oxytocin. The problem with oxytocin is that it's temporary. So there are 2 hours of, you know, effect. Mm-hmm. And this is also the reason why we administrate intranasally oxytocin to the mice 30 minutes before behavior. Right. And the problem is that it's so temporary, the effect, that the children with, that, you know, know, use oxytocin to ameliorate the quality of life, they have to spray oxytocin, you know, every day, every couple of hours. It's, you know, it's a pretty invasive treatment and not very, you know, long-lasting. And so Rutray, if Rutray can increase endogenously oxytocin, it would be a less invasive treatment that children can, you know, be treated all over their life.
So ideally, you're looking for a mechanism kind of to treat the brain without having to have such an invasive procedure.
Exactly.
And whether or not L-Rutray is the answer to that, we still have to do the research to figure out what about L-Rutray, what specific pathway it's
Exactly. I think it's we have an amazing opportunity now that we have understood that specific microbes can modulate brain function. Mm-hmm. We have this amazing opportunity to, you know, maybe these are really important not invasive treatment that can be combined or by itself to improve some of the behavior. Of course, we cannot say that we can improve all the symptoms, but at least some of them.
Yeah. So as you start to kind of get to the end of your postdoc, I know most people start thinking about, you know, how they're going to start up their own lab afterwards. And how do you see yourself moving into this kind of microbiome social behavior field while differentiating yourself from the work that you've done previously?
So, well, actually, I'm very, very much attracted by the, you know, translation of the research to the clinic. So I don't think I want to, I see myself in the academia system forever, but I still want to be in science because I'm passionate about science. So I think I want to keep on being a scientist and work on this field, but maybe not in the academia.
Yeah, that's really nice to hear, because I know as we go through the graduate school track, most of the advice that we get is to pursue the academia field. And there are other ways to be a scientist outside of
academia. There are so many other ways,
And I think it's important to get that realization. I also noticed, I went to your LinkedIn, and I saw that you had gone to the Rice-Jones Business School.
Yeah.
for kind of a learning about entrepreneurship and scientists. Do you think, what is the value of kind of studying entrepreneurship for a scientist?
I think it's amazing. And I suggest this course to anybody who's interested in, you know, expand their knowledge. It's very important also for a scientist who wants to stay in academia, because we have to deal with, you know, industry and companies all the time, also in academia for collaboration or, you know, there are very important collaborations. Sometimes they are born from these two different worlds. So, it was super interesting. And I think anybody should working in academia should also expand their knowledge on the startup company system and all of this, you know.
Yeah. Are there any other fields that we think are helpful for scientists? Should we go into, like, studying law school? Should we study?
Well, if you're interested in patents, you know, it could also be helpful, because you have to, you know, carry out some patents sometimes while you are in academia. But I think the most important thing is to also be able to share scientific knowledge in the right way, so to be able to communicate with people that are not scientists. It is a very important thing, because, you know, anytime you publish a paper and then, you know, there is this media coverage that is keep bringing your information outside, and that can be, you know, read in many different ways from people that do not have the knowledge to filter the information and understand what they mean.
Yeah, certainly. I think communication is important in science. And we talk about, you know, we always have teams of varying degrees of expertise. You know, we have some neurobiologists, they work with microbiologists, and now they're both studying the microbiome together.
Absolutely.
And I think it's important to kind of differentiate your expertise, have a group that kind of has a bunch of different skill sets and bring them together. And I was wondering what advice you have for someone who's more younger in the research field, someone who's kind of just getting into the field of a PhD. What advice would you have for them to kind of figure out what projects they want to pursue?
Explore a lot. Like, you know, be surrounded by people, you know, older than you, with more experience than you, and ask a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Just be driven by curiosity, and don't be afraid to ask any, also the more simple question, because, you know, this is what actually then drive you. If you are especially a scientist, you have to keep your passion alive, otherwise it's a difficult world, right? It's not an easy
job. What if you have a little bit of that social anxiety and you're not sure, could I take L-Rutray maybe to help with that or no?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, really great. So I was wondering, in addition to kind of where you see your lab moving forward, what kind of, or where your research moving forward, what kind of aspects are important for the career development of kind of younger postdocs or people who are moving into kind of postdoctoral positions? You mentioned you were looking mainly at Mauro's research and this opportunity to really go into a new field that was different than your own in PhD, but what else do you think is important for the career development of a young postdoc?
I think one of the most important things is to learn also how to deal with people and collaborate with people in the most productive way, not just in the lab, but also outside the lab. And this allows you not only to learn new techniques and to increase, you know, to dig deeper in and expand your knowledge on other fields, but, you know, networking is very important part of our job. And most of the time, scientists are very much concentrated on themselves. Like, so, you know, this idea of the scientist closing the lab without a social, you know, life. Yeah. But it's, you know, a very important aspect that we'll come back and help ourselves in many other ways in the future. Yeah. When you are a postdoc, when you are a PI. So, you know, networking is also very important.
Very important. And then I was wondering, what questions do you think the field needs to answer with regards to kind of social behavior, or even kind of our understanding of autism spectrum disorder is so kind of superficial, it's on a very surface level. What questions do you think are the next big ones that we really need to hit on?
Regarding social behavior.
Regarding social behavior or kind of microbiome modification, since those are the two kind of fields that you're working in right now.
Okay, well, I think understanding the mechanism by which the bacteria modulate brain function would be very important so that we can understand whether there are other alternative therapies, because we don't know whether we can use this therapeutic approach for the future. So understanding the mechanism, so if we know that, you know, the bacteria is activating the vagus nerve, maybe vagus nerve stimulation could be important for ASD. So understanding mechanisms that would bring us a lot of other, you know, input and our would expand our knowledge to be able to understand whether other therapies can be, you know, used. And yeah, I think this is one of the most important things to understand.
Yeah, these really you want to have the specific mechanisms. And you think that with these mechanisms understood, we'll be able to develop therapeutics that are specific enough?
Maybe not for all the symptoms, but for some of the symptoms, yes. And of course, we have to remember this basic science done in animals. So before being able to say that this can be translated to human, we have to, you know, reproduce this data in any other more translational animal models and to do clinical trials. So, you know, there is a long, long route. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I can't wait to see what you're going to come up with next and the research
that
you're
going to
come up with. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Rhonda and Dr. Skrita shared with us two different ways of studying the microbiome and gave us a look into what they have done to position themselves to be successful. To study a system as complex as the microbiome, it is important to really break it down and not be afraid to ask what you feel are the fundamental questions. So I want to thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. For more of our content, you can follow us on Twitter at GutBrains or visit our website at thinkgastronauts.com. The Gastronauts podcast would be impossible without the incredible team that we have here. Meredith Schmell is our producer and theme music composer. And special thanks to the founders of Gastronauts, Dr. Diego Borquez and the Borquez Laboratory.